Hello and welcome to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I'm your host, Ellen Jackson, and it's my mission to share the science of human behaviour in a practical, fun and inspiring way. In each podcast episode, I interview an expert from the fields of psychology, well-being, leadership, parenting or high performance. I pick their brain to uncover what they know about living well, what tips do they have for you and I, and I quiz them about how they apply their expertise in their own life. Join me as we discover simple, science-backed ways to live, learn, flourish, and fulfill your potential. Hello, and welcome back to the Potential Psychology Podcast. I am your host, Ellen Jackson, and I am indeed a psychologist. Perhaps not the type of psychologist that comes to mind. I think there's a general perception that psychologists are there to provide counselling services and to assist you when perhaps you are struggling with some aspect of your life or emotional life and well-being. And that's absolutely what a lot of psychologists do. It's admirable work, and it is the work of many of my colleagues. But I'm actually a different kind of psychologist. I am a workplace and coaching psychologist, and I operate, I'd say, at the performance end of the spectrum. So that is a lot of psychoeducation, as we call it, talking to people about well-being, the topics that we cover in this very podcast. And I do that often in workplaces, and I do one-on-one coaching work with people who are looking to achieve particular goals or perhaps gain a little extra insight into how they operate in order to live to their full potential. So if we haven't met before, hi, nice to have you here. Welcome. This is the podcast where we do talk about fulfilling your potential, and we interview a whole lot of experts who can give us a little insight into how best to do that. But before I tell you about our guest today, who you may well have heard of, particularly if you are here in Australia, I wanted to share with you a couple of things that I learned this week. And it's not really perhaps what I learned, but what I'm reading, and some books, and books I would like to read. So books, as if you've been listening for a while, you'll know that most of my guests, when it comes to talking books, will say, oh, I've got a library full of books, love a book. And they always have plenty of excellent recommendations. And so one of those that came across my path recently was a book that I haven't read yet, but I've certainly put it on my list, and it's called Why We Sleep, The New Science of Sleep and Dreams, and it's written by Matthew Walker. And I haven't read this yet, but I'm intrigued by it because sleep is something that I talk about a lot when I'm talking to workplaces about, you know, what are the baseline components of well-being? What are the things that we really need to be doing in order to remain resilient and thrive and flourish? And sleep is absolutely one of those. And I know it's not always an easy thing for everybody to obtain. So when I was talking about this online, I posted a little thing on Instagram recently. I had a couple of colleagues highly recommend this book by Matthew Walker, Why We Sleep, The New Science of Sleep and Dreams. So if you're interested in understanding more about sleep and dreams, which is a topic that really intrigues me, this might be a book for you to take a look at. It's certainly a topic that we haven't covered yet on the Potential Psychology Podcast, but one that I am keen to cover. So that might be a goal for 2019, is to get an expert here to talk to us about sleep. The other book that I have not only come across, I've actually been reading for the last couple of weeks, is a book called 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote to Chaos. And it's written by the somewhat controversial psychologist Jordan Peterson. Now, I haven't delved too deeply into the whys of controversy surrounding Dr. Peterson. I know him as a psychologist, a very well-respected psychologist, certainly a very thoughtful man when you read this book, but he has said things that I know have upset people. I suspect it's not so much his intention, but perhaps the interpretation of what he's said. Some topics around identity and gender pronouns, I know, became a hot topic a year or so ago. He's also reportedly on a meat-only diet, which does sound a little odd to me, but I'm going to suspend my judgment on that one because I haven't looked into it and haven't read what he's got to say on the topic or why, in fact, he is pursuing a meat-only diet, if in fact that's the case, and what it's doing for him. But his book, this book, 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote for Chaos, is absolutely an incredibly thoughtful, deep, wide-ranging, interesting book. Really interesting book. It really makes you think. I'm not sure that I absolutely agree with all of his thoughts, although there is a small part of me that says I just don't have the intellectual capability to even be fully across what he says. It is, you know, really, it is an intellectually rigorous book, and the topics that he covers amongst his 12 rules for life, you know, what I do love about it is that he's able to kind of work across some incredible depth in terms of the topic. So he's covering comparative religion and historical stories and cultural stories that make his point, but then also talk about some really practical elements of what it's like to parent, for example, and give really practical examples. So it's got something in there for everyone if you're interested in understanding somebody else's perspective, particularly if, you know, somebody who has clearly thought about the topics a lot. But his 12 rules for life are things like, and I won't give them all to you, stand up straight with your shoulders back, compare yourself to who you were yesterday, not to who someone else is today, which I think is pretty wise advice, pursue what is meaningful, not what is expedient, be precise in your speech, and pet a cat when you encounter one on the street. I haven't got to that topic yet. I'm looking forward to that. So, look, if you're interested in something that's going to make you really think, that I think is wise guidance in terms of rules for life and is really intellectually challenging, I find it intellectually challenging, you might like to give it a go. It's Jordan B. Peterson, and it's 12 Rules for Life, An Antidote for Chaos. So there's a couple of books that I thought I might share with you this week. While we're talking controversial, I'm going to introduce our guest for today. I don't think he's necessarily controversial, certainly not in the same way that Jordan Peterson has been, but he certainly has some firm views on children, adolescents, parenting and well-being, and whether or not we're doing the right things for our kids right now. My guest today is Dr. Michael Cargreg, who is one of Australia's highest profile psychologists. He's the author of 11 books, a broadcaster, a specialist in parenting children, adolescents, and the use of technology for mental health. He's a consultant psychologist for CP Consultant, chair of digital education for Innerwell, which is a joint venture between the University of Sydney and PricewaterhouseCoopers, which aims to transform mental health care in Australia and around the world through digital technology. Michael sits on the board of the Family Peace Foundation. He's a community ambassador for Smiling Mind and Big Brother, Big Sister, and a columnist for a number of media publications and the resident parenting expert for several high-rating Australian television and radio programs. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you for having me.
I'm thrilled to have you. I think this is going to be a really interesting conversation because what we're talking about is the mental health and well-being of our community, particularly our young people. Could I start by asking you, what is the state of mental health and well-being for our community generally?
Well, I'm afraid it's not great. By all accounts, we are having the highest youth suicide rate in 10 years. We have a doubling of youth suicide amongst young women, which is very concerning. Rates of deliberate self-harm have increased. A study done by Harriet Hiscock, published in the Medical Journal of Australia just recently, showed a doubling of the number of early adolescents turning up to accident emergency for self-harm and a tripling of young people turning up for mental health presentations. So by any objective analysis, you'd have to say that the situation's pretty grim.
Why is this from your perspective? Because clearly, you know, we've put a lot of effort into trying to rectify this situation.
We've spent a lot of money, and one would have to ask whether it's gone in the right place. What I would say to you is that I don't think social media is our friend. I think Instagram and Snapchat in particular have had a devastating impact on not all, but some young people. I think that the rise of cyberbullying, as documented by the Office of the Safety Commissioner, is particularly worrying. So the whole internet thing, I think, is worrying. The use of mobile phones are a distraction. There's no doubt to me about that. And while there's no firm evidence, My suspicion is that it does increase the prevalence of image-based abuse in schools. It does increase cyberbullying and potentially is a risk factor which is amenable to change, but no one so far has had the courage to do that. So we'll have to wait and see what happens. In addition, I think there's a really interesting phenomenon known as developmental compression, where the physical development of our boys and girls are shooting ahead of their psychological development, so that our 14 is in fact their 10. And even though physically they look much bigger than us, psychologically they still have the young person's brain. So I think that societal expectations on these young people is probably greater than they can bear. I don't think they've got the social and emotional competencies to manage what life is throwing at them, particularly in the form of conflict resolution, anger management, problem solving, decision making. And we know that that's a key component of resilience. I also worry that we don't have enough adults around young people at critical times, particularly young women. And this was a point Steve Bidoff made in his 2013 book, Raising Girls. He said that what we needed was an auntie's army, a whole lot of people that basically would broaden the social network for young people and sustain them. The great parenting expert Maggie Beer calls these people lighthouse people, people who sort of literally guide young people through, you know, the darkness and when the psychological rain and the storms gather. And quite obviously, for some, not all young people, there seems to be a paucity of these charismatic adults. So you've got the social emotional competencies, the lack of charismatic adults. And also, I think there's a concept that I really love of islands of competence, or what Steve Bidoff used to call spark. And that is, I think when young people are doing one thing, they can't be doing another. And I was very moved by an interesting study they did in Iceland. 20 years ago, Icelandic young people were the heaviest drinkers and smokers in Europe. And the Icelandic government decided to do something about it. And they actually did something very radical. What they did was they introduced a whole lot of legislation which made it illegal for young people under 18 to smoke and unable to drink at 20, till they were 20. Fascinating. They then paid parents $600 each per child for vouchers for activities for their children, like art, music, dance, drama, sport. And they introduced late night curfews for the week, so that if you're a young person, say under 16, you weren't allowed out after 9 o'clock. Today, they are the cleanest living young people in Europe.
How interesting.
The rate of binge drinking had dropped 90% in those 20 years. And it just was allied with compulsory parent education in schools, where all parents were mandated to have really good lessons. For example, the Triple P parenting program would offer here in Australia, but it was mandatory. And the result is that the vast majority of these kids grew up feeling safe, valued and listened to. They had their islands of competence. They were able to take healthy risks. And goodness, if we can't learn from the Icelandic experience, I don't know what else we can do.
Okay. So I'm going to unpick some of those bits and pieces that you've spoken about there, because there's a huge amount in there. And I can imagine our listeners, particularly those who are parents, are going, oh my goodness, where do I start? This is about balance of risk and protective factors, which is a term that we understand as psychologists, but perhaps for our audience, could you just explain what they mean?
So when we look at an individual human being, we look at their sort of four worlds that they live in. One world is their understanding of family and their relationship within the family, their relationship and understanding of school, their relationship and understanding of peer groups, and the relationship and understanding of themselves. Within those four domains, what we find is that there are clear risk factors. So, for example, if you grow up in an environment where your friends are all using illicit substances, that's a risk factor an odds ratio risk factor that greatly increases the likelihood of you using. If you, on the other hand, have an island of competence like art, music, dance, drama, sport, that dramatically reduces the risk of you involving yourself in unhealthy, compromising, risk-taking behavior. So we have from the University of Washington a model called the social development model, which is very complex. But what that's done over 50 years is given us a very clear understanding, and it allows us to predict with a lot of accuracy what trajectory one single individual is on. Most importantly, as psychologists, it allows us to intervene, because if we have an accurate picture of the balance of risk and protective factors in those four worlds, what that enables us to do is reduce the risk factors and increase the protective factors. That would be our kind of what we call a psychological formulation. Where do we go from here with this kid once we've got the information? So I hope that makes it a little clearer.
It does. And so what are in those four domains, which I think is helpful for us to be able, because I'm a parent, so I'm thinking about this as a parent as well as thinking about it as a psychologist. If we've got these four components, being able to think, okay, I'm looking at my child, I'm looking at their family situation, I'm looking at their schooling situation, looking at their peer group, and then their understanding of themselves, what are some of the protective factors? What are some of the factors that help a child in each of those domains?
Okay, well, if we look at the sort of inner world of the child, having flexible self-talk is a really big thing. So every single child that I see has a little conversation going on inside their head pretty much most of the time they're awake. And the way in which they think really does influence directly how they feel and then how they behave. If they have very rigid self-talk, if they catastrophize, live by fixed rules, etc., you generally find that their thinking makes it very difficult to feel good, and they'll probably be more likely to feel anxious, to feel depressed, and to have a negative view of the future. What we try and do in my type of therapy, which is cognitive behavioral therapy, is help them understand the link between the way they think and the way they feel and the way they behave, and get them to sensibly analyze their particular thought processes, ask themselves, is this helpful? Are there other ways I could think about this? And generally, we get a pretty good bang for our buck. If we can change that, boy, we can make a big difference. So that rigid self-talk's a big risk factor. In the family, being brought up in an environment where you don't feel safe, you don't feel valued, and you don't feel listened to, where basically you've got very strict parenting, where you are required to obey all the time, there's not a lot of love, there's not a lot of consultation. That's actually a major risk factor. And that's the type of parenting we call authoritarian parenting. And it's not actually very helpful at all. Unfortunately, there are remnants of it still in Australian society. And the more you move away from the city, I think the more likely you are to find that type of parenting, which is relevant, obviously, for where you live.
The old school, do as I say or else type.
That's approach. It. Yep. You've got it in one. Yep. In terms of school, we know that bullying and harassment, both on and offline, is a major risk factor. The short, medium, long-term consequences can be devastating, can include anxiety, depression, self-harm, suicidal ideation, and as we saw in January this year with Dolly Everett, completed suicide. So we have to take that bullying thing very, very seriously. I always say to parents, it's important to understand that it's not a matter of if your child is going to be bullied, it's when, and have you done enough to prepare them for that eventuality? Do they know how to respond, both on and offline? And that's, I think, a major strategy. We now know from the research that has been done that the most powerful tool is equipping our young people with the skills and the knowledge and strategies to fight back verbally, to manage verbally. And that doesn't mean being aggressive, quite the opposite. It means fogging. So if somebody comes up to you and says, you're fat and ugly, you go, well, maybe, and walk away. Very, very powerful. So there are a million techniques like that which we need to start teaching our young people. So that leaves then the peer, we've got the peer group, which is essentially as I mentioned earlier, if you hang out with disaffected, disaffiliated people, they're going to have an impact on you. On the other hand, if your child is a member of Scouts or Guides, or they're into the local AFL club or the local netball club, what the research shows is that those activities, as we saw from the Icelandic example, is a huge protective factor, because you're actually getting young people to take health risks. So they're helping to discover who they are, which is a big question for all young people. Who am I? You're perhaps even allowing them to form close relationships with the adults around that particular sport, mentors in the form of coaches. So they could be charismatic adults. And thirdly, you allow these young people to associate with other young people who have similar attitudes, values, and beliefs. So by and large, everyone wins.
Mm. And that's been really interesting for me as a parent, because I spent a long time in Melbourne and in Sydney in urban areas. We moved here about 6 years ago when the kids were small. And the sense of connection and community that comes through, particularly we're quite involved in some of the sporting groups, but even the schools, I think, you know, there's fewer degrees of separation in a smaller community. And whilst that probably has some downsides, I think the upsides have certainly been, from my observation, that sense of having other people around you, that community, the connection. And certainly with sport, for example, I think a lot of engagement and even just the physical exercise, you know, that I can see the kids kind of thrive from.
And there's a paradox there then, because if everything you said was to be true, that would be a major protective factor. Yet the suicides in rural and remote Australia are three times higher than that in the city. So is that a service provision issue? Is that an alienation, isolation issue? Fascinating.
It is fascinating.
I don't know the answer.
No, and I don't either. And very sadly, we do have a particularly high suicide rate. Even recently, we've had a number of fathers for school kids that we're connected to, men in their 40s probably, who have completed suicide in recent months. And so we know it's a problem, and yet, yeah, I can. There is a paradox. Absolutely, I can see the pluses, but there's challenges.
There's something very sick about our society when the leading cause of death for 15 to 44 year old men is in fact suicide. Part of the problem is financial provision for mental health services, particularly in rural and remote Australia. It's interesting for your listeners and viewers to reflect on the fact that in Australia, between 5 to 8% of the health budget goes to mental health. In the UK, which is no beacon of light in mental health, it's 13%. Mm. So that's, I think, an interesting thing to reflect on.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. So, Michael, one of the things that you mentioned, and I think that has helped a lot to kind of frame up, you know, what are the things that as parents or our listeners or people who are looking after young people, involved in young people in our community, what are the domains that they need to consider? Where are the kind of those pluses and minuses? One of the things you mentioned was technology. And I know that it is a scary thing for a lot of parents. I know for a lot of us who did not grow up with a lot of the digital media, certainly not social media, find the prospect of their kids involved in that world quite confronting. You're quite an advocate of technology in some areas.
I am.
Yeah. How does it work for you? You know, there's obviously some minuses, but are there pluses, and what should we be making of this?
Yeah, I think we've got to be careful with technology. I mean, I've said that I don't think Instagram and Snapchat are the friends of young people, and I firmly believe that. However, technology affords you and I to have this conversation without me having to drive to Ballarat or you to come to Melbourne.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly, the federal government has, in fact, enabled me to have these conversations. 7 out of my 10 Medicare sessions can now be through this medium. That's marvelous for people in the country. That makes a huge difference. So there's one example of where technology is fantastic. The other thing is, I am talking tonight at a fundraiser in Geelong on the use of technology to build young people's wellbeing. So we'll have a whole bunch of workers with young people in health, education, and welfare. And we're talking to them about What are the apps, the websites, the biometric devices which we can use now clinically to augment what we do in our clinical work? And I think that that's brilliant. The idea that there might be an app, for example, like Reach Out Breathe, which is an app that uses the camera to pick up your heartbeat and should be having an anxiety attack, takes you through a beautiful exercise to reduce the rate at which you breathe, all on an iPhone. It's literally like having a psychologist in your pocket. Now, that is gold. I can't be with my clients every second of the day, but you can bet your bottom dollar that their phone will be. And I'd be happy to talk to you in another session about all the wonderful apps and websites that there are. My favorite website is one called Mood Gym, which is 20 years old, developed by Professor Helen Christensen when she was the professor of psychology at ANU. It's been subjected to 7 randomized controlled trials. Here's something that's been found to be able to be incredibly useful for young people with mild to moderate anxiety and depression, and to be as good as sitting in a room with someone like us.
So technology is not all bad. There's obviously a lot of benefits. What would you say, or what do you say to parents with regard to some of these social media? Because it is a bit of a fraught exercise when you've got kids, everybody's on it. Mum, why can't I go on it too? And you're a bit concerned about what this might lead to.
Sure. I don't believe anyone should be on the adult social media under the age of 13, and neither do the social media companies. Yep. Unfortunately, we can see with Fortnite, which is also not rated for people under the age of 13, that both kids and parents have ignored that left, right and center. And that's sort of become the crack cocaine of the internet. So what we have to do is empower the parents to set limits and boundaries. I personally believe that for every hour of screen time, you should have an hour of green time. Much easier in Ballarat, perhaps, than if you live in a high rise in the middle of Melbourne. Mm. But I still think the principle stands. And I think we need to teach young people the skills to use the internet in a safe, smart, responsible way. We need to let them know that if they are bullied, which will happen online, they're not to respond. They are to save the evidence. They are to report the abuse, and they are to expect someone to do something about it. Similarly, we would want people to never post anything on social media that they wouldn't want their parents, the police, a pedophile, or their principal to see. The 4P rule.
Yeah.
And that we should treat everyone online as we would wish to be treated. So there are these basics. And of course, there's a fantastic website now, which I'm recommending to all parents, which is the iParent website, put out by Julie Inman Grant and the Office of the eSafety Commissioner. I think this is vital. It's as important now to be across this stuff as a parent as it is to teach a child to swim or to cross the road safely.
And I did have a really interesting conversation with Martine Oglethorpe on this topic. So she works also with the Office for eSafety. Yeah. And does a lot of parent education, and a lot of the things that you mentioned there were things that she certainly talked about, you know, that it's no good for parents to just close their eyes and block their ears and say, I don't want to know, I don't want to know, that it's very much part of our parenting responsibility to be actively involved in understanding the technology and what our kids are doing with it, and then enforcing the kind of boundaries that work. And one of the things that we discussed that I'd be interested in your take on was the role of individual difference, you know, understanding your kid and what's helping and what's not helping them with regard to technology, because they will differ. Do you think that plays a part, or is it more black and white for you?
No, I think that is one of the things that's difficult in this space is one makes these sort of blanket statements, and of course it denies the existence of the individual psychology component. Every single child is different. They're, you know, 23 chromosomes from you, 23 perhaps slightly imperfect chromosomes from the other person that you procreated with. Throw in the genetic roll of the dice and you get kids with different temperaments, different dispositions, different interests. I have clients who have no interest in technology whatsoever. And I rejoice in their individualism, and I think that's fantastic. So, of course, you have to have I think, a very curated approach. One of the big challenges I have for all parents is, do you know your kid? You know, are you the world expert on your child? You need to be, because otherwise you're not going to pick up the signs of depression or anxiety, particularly the incipient signs. And we know that prompt diagnosis, prompt treatment is associated with a much better outcome. So to me, that's very important. One thing I would say to your devoted audience is that there are four things that I want them to really concentrate on in terms of the well-being of their sons and daughters. The first is, assuming that they're not on the spectrum, do they have the ability to obtain, maintain, and retain friendships? I think we're now clear from positive psychology that one of the greatest predictors of well-being is not being good-looking, it's not having more good things happen to you or bad, it's not even about having lots of money, it's really about having the ability to borrow friends. That's a great predictor of well-being. So if your kid doesn't have that, that's a problem. Secondly, do they understand and enjoy school? And while they might not initially, eventually they need to understand that this is actually about acquiring the skills for future economic independence. And it's very, very important. And I think parents play a major role in being enthusiastic about that. Thirdly, I would argue that they need to have that spark, that thing that gets them up in the morning. And I don't care if it's art, music, dance, drama, sport. And if your child doesn't have one, then it's your job, not the school's, your job to help them find it. And that's about giving them a smorgasbord of opportunities. And eventually, if you persist, you'll find one that they like. And lastly, I think it's really about emancipation. Does your child have the capacity to go on a sleepover? Can they go on school, stand up in front of a class and give a speech? Do they have the capacity to be away from you for a prolonged period of time? These are the four key things that I'm asking parents to be aware of. And if you've got problems with at least two of them, then you probably need to go to your GP, get a referral to a good child or adolescent psychologist, and do something about it.
Yeah, okay, excellent guidelines there. There's two things I really like to follow up on there. One is the spark. So I practice in the area of positive psychology, so I know about the importance of what we call engagement, you know, getting that sense of flow, being so absorbed in a task or activity that gives us energy. There are kids, you know, again, it comes back to that individual difference. For some, it's very obvious what they get a kick out of, and being able to afford them the opportunity to do that is not that difficult. What about the kids who you might be the most conscientious parent, you know your child, and you're just going, I don't know that they've found their thing yet. Yeah. How would you advise them?
So all children have kind of different maturities. There's the physical maturity, which is the one that you can see, but there's also intellectual and emotional maturity. And I think everybody develops at their own pace. And I haven't found the magic formula to hurry that along yet, not in 30 years. Many parents wish I had. But I think you've just got to be patient, and you have to be the one that consistently offers them the opportunity and never stop. You just have to persist. And I think eventually it's a little bit like that friend at work who you're a bit worried about. And you go, are you okay? And they go, yep. And you keep going back to them. And eventually, when it's abundantly clear things aren't okay, in many ways, they're just testing you to see how much you care.
Yep.
I think our children can be a little bit the same way. I had a son who fell in love, fortunately, with cricket. And this is a little boy who at 8 slept with his cricket bat, for goodness sake.
I have one who sleeps with the basketball.
Oh, sweet. And I think that's a very, very good sign. This kid played till he was 21 when he injured his back. But I can tell you that it afforded him the most amazing opportunities, not just a trip to Sri Lanka and to understand other cultures, but it just gave him the opportunity to learn about winning and losing, meeting a whole lot of people who he probably would never have met otherwise. So I'm a huge enthusiast of that, and I think you have to persist.
Okay, so a bit of persistence. And I did speak to Rachel Collar, who's at the University of Melbourne, at the Centre for Positive Psychology there, in my last podcast discussion about, so she's doing some research around pathways and agency and hope and purpose for kids, so helping them to find, I guess, that spark, really, that bit of insight into who am I and what lights me up. And we were talking about the role of the parent, perhaps, in really watching kids and seeing those little sparks, you know, just that element of observation. And because they can be so different, and then talking to them about, you know, what is it that you love about, say, Minecraft, for example, or what is it that you love about building things out of Lego, or, you know, whatever it might be, and helping to kind of, I suppose, unpack it that way a little bit.
I think that's so interesting. I love these academics because what they say makes so much sense. But in the real world, when you actually talk to busy mums and dads who are so time poor, you know, you're lucky these days to get parents who can spend just 8 minutes a day in a conversation without the phone, sitting down, looking them in the eye, asking them questions like that. And I think they're brilliant questions. Really focusing on their responses and then reflecting back to them what they've said so they have the opportunity to clarify it. All of that's great. The difficulty is parents are so busy these days. And one thing that, you know, we talked about risk factors earlier, a sort of global risk factor now, I think, is that many families have had to move to get jobs.
Mm.
And in moving, they've smashed the kinship networks that used to be taken for granted. And so many parents I'm working with in 2018 have actually got busy jobs, and they've been left really for the very first time to raise their children by themselves. And their parents weren't great role models. So they're really struggling to find the formula to get stuff right, which is, I guess, why podcasts like yours are so popular and so useful.
Yeah. Well, so what is it that we can do? I mean, as you said that, I'm thinking, well, you know, I was living in Sydney, my family in Melbourne, my husband's family in Canberra. I was living in Sydney when we had the children. We've moved now to regional Australia, which is closer to my family, but we're still not, you know, it's not the day to day kind of connection that perhaps families had in the past. What can we do about that? What can we do about the fact that there's busy jobs?
I think grandparents are very important. I think they're far more important than most people realize. And I think they are the historians of the family. And I think we need to put them in the way of grandparents as much as possible. Fortunately, we do have technology still, so we can FaceTime and we can have those conversations. I just think we need to make it more of a priority in our family than many families do, along with ritual. So the research around ritual and tradition is so profound. Yet many families that I work with clinically have no rituals, have no tradition. And I think that's so sad, because I often wonder what's going to happen to those children when they're bouncing their children on their knee. What was it like being in your family?
Mm.
They won't have anything to say.
Mm. So we're coming up to Christmas, talking about that ritual. I know I wrote a blog post some years ago when I first came across that research around ritual and
yep.
The role that even, because I think for those families perhaps who have a deep cultural practice around their, you know, religion or something else, that may be part and parcel of what you do. But as we've become, a lot of us, less connected to that, you know, I sort of, when I read that research, said, well, what are our rituals around our family? And we do have them. We have a weekly holiday, three generations with each of the two families. So my family of origin, my husband's family of origin, that I know the kids love. There's rituals around, well, even Christmas Day changes every year, but camping at Easter time, those sorts of things are the things that I've kind of considered rituals for our family. Have you got other suggestions or things that you talk about parents with around this?
Yeah, one of my favorite rituals, and it comes straight out of positive psychology, is the whole idea of saying to your sons or daughters, at the end of every day, what were three good things that happened to you today? The what went well and why. I think that's almost from the University of the Bleeding Obvious. I can't imagine why you wouldn't do that now. But there are other rituals. My parents used to have this ritual where we'd have a fondue on a particular day of the week, and if you lost your piece of meat on the end of the fondue fork, you'd have to stand up and go around the table and kiss everybody. So that was, I remember hating that at eight, but I made my own children do it. So I think those are sort of family traditions. There's, I've come across families that have special handshakes, they have special code words. To me, it's about creating a sense of usness, of belonging. Okay. And if you look at the resilience literature, which I'm always fascinated in, there's no question at all that the idea of having something, feeling part of something that's bigger than yourself, is a very, very important component of that resilience.
Yeah. And that's, I think, a lovely way to phrase it. And I think even that just belongingness, because that is something we can find ways to do in pretty simple terms. Just funny, even the in jokes for the family, or, you know, knowing that those little things are making a difference in terms of connectedness for kids.
Sure. My kids still come over on, they've left home, but they come home Sunday and we all have a meal together. And they've just started bringing their girlfriends, which is somewhat disturbing, but no, it's good. It's fun. It's just more expensive.
My father started taking my sister and I on a holiday once a year when we were sort of teens. I guess one of those connectedness things. He had a really busy job and we didn't see him as much as we did mum. So he took us away when we were kind of 16 or 19. And over time, that now means that he now takes a whole 11 people away because he's acquired two sons-in-law and five grandchildren. So, yeah.
I think that's my future.
It might be your future as well. Look, it's a glorious, glorious thing. Michael, just one final topic, and that is the role of schools in all of this. I think there is a lot of tension in people's mind. I certainly observe in conversation a kind of a, you know, where does the responsibility lie in with things like bullying, things like even, you know, because I know talking to teachers, it's complex to try and fit in the curriculum as it stands and then want to be able to do more of this wellbeing piece too. What's your view on that?
Yeah, I think teachers are the most important people in our society. And if I was in charge, which I never will be, but if I was, I'd pay them double what they get paid. I'd make it harder to go to teacher training college than medicine or law, because these are the people who hold in their hands every day the future of our country. So I feel sorry for schools at the moment. I think school teachers are under enormous stress. I think the curriculum is ridiculous. I think that they're constantly being told that they have to do things like cyber safety, road safety, pornography. Virtually every single subject under the sun is suddenly their responsibility. I think there's way too much outsourcing of parental responsibility to schools. That's what I would say. I think the curriculum is too crowded. I don't like NAPLAN. I'm not a fan. I understand the need to measure. I think the way in which they've done it is counterproductive and unhelpful. And the fact that it was introduced in 2009, and the fact that we're now ranked below Kazakhstan in mathematics would suggest to me that it hasn't quite worked in the way that they want. So I look at schools as almost pressure cookers. I really worry about the year 12 students. I've written two books on surviving year 12, and I'm about to write my third. They have the highest levels of morbidity and mortality. And I'm desperately worried about their psychological well-being. Many of them seem to think they are their ATAR, their Australian Tertiary Admissions Rank. I want to send a message that it doesn't matter what your score is, life will still be worth living. And that the only time anybody's ever going to ask you your score is when it comes out, and after that, no one cares. So I think we need to really read the whole year 12 stuff. I know of 12 young people just in Victoria alone this year who've stood in front of trains rather than have to sit the exam. And I think when you get to that stage, you need to reevaluate.
And where's the hope in that? I mean, that's a very, very grim picture. And I must admit, as a parent who hasn't got to that point yet, I'm hoping things are going to change in the next 6, 7, 8 years. You know, where is the hope? Is there stuff being done to rectify the situation?
The difficulty is the universities have a very clear imperative, and that is that they want to cherry pick the brightest and the best, and this is the system that works best for them. But it doesn't take into account the fact that young people don't all develop at the same time. Some people are good at sitting exams and some aren't, and that doesn't actually reflect on their ability or how good they'd be to be lawyers or doctors or psychologists for that matter. So I'm afraid I don't see too much hope. I don't think that anyone is seriously thinking of reforming the system. A few vice chancellors have said that they agree with me that ATAR, the ATAR is a blunt, stupid instrument and we need to replace it with something else. So we've got them to that point, but that's just awareness. It's not action. So I'm not optimistic that things will have changed by the time your son hits year 12, but I know he's got a wonderful mother who will support him and be a cheer squad.
Doing her best, and his father and both of them. Okay. So if I'm not, but for my listeners who are parents of kids in those upper years of school, what do we need to be doing? What do we need to be looking out for, and how do we need to be supporting our kids through that really tough time?
I think we need to teach them how to study smart. The basics are to make sure that they prioritize sleep. Sleep's the single most important study tool going around. To make sure that they have a clear protocol where they never study more than 20 minutes at a time without taking a break, where they hydrate themselves. They eat heaps of blueberries, yogurt and eggs, because those are the brain foods that really make a difference. That they don't skip breakfast, which 32% of them do. That's catastrophic, because the sole source of energy for the brain is, in fact, glucose, which comes from carbohydrates, and you're not going to have any of that on board if you skip breakfast. So there are fundamental issues like this, to get exercise, to remember that if you want to remember something really well, say it out loud or try to explain it to someone else. These are the sort of absolute fundamentals. There's an excellent website that reachout.com have put together advising parents and students about how to cope with year 12. I commend it to you.
Excellent. Okay, I'm making a note of that. And is there anything else that you know, if we're going to take an I'm going to try and take an optimistic view of the future and just know that, you know, by the very fact that we're having this conversation and sharing perhaps the concerns about things that have not helped kids and our young people over time, where are the positives? Are things changing for you? Is there a path to change?
Yeah, you're much younger than me, so I'm allowed to be a little bit jaded and cynical. I love the fact that you're still optimistic. I don't think anything will change until there's resource allocation changes. The 5 to 8% is unacceptable for our mental health services. They're massively underfunded. Everybody says so. It doesn't matter who you talk to. We announced yesterday was $58 million to Headspace. But what you're doing there is you're building a lot more ambulances at the bottom of the cliff. You're not doing anything to create the robust fences at the top. I think there's more we need to do on wellbeing, particularly if I was schools, I'd be pushing the sleep stuff, the exercise stuff, the diet stuff in particular, and mindfulness. I just think that we need to look at those four pillars of wellbeing and start incorporating them into what we do at home and, of course, what we do at school.
And I think that's a lovely note to finish on, in part because those four, what we call, and I know Dr. Susie Green said that one of her students, or I can't remember who it was, called them, you know, taking your meds, that mindfulness, exercise, diet and sleep as the four pillars. And that comes up in so many of the conversations that I have with our colleagues about them being really the basics of wellbeing. And they are things that we can all do for ourselves and model for our kids around getting enough sleep, eating well, making sure we're moving and being mindful in every day. And I think I personally believe, and maybe it's because I'm an optimist, but I think, you know, just by having this conversation, all those wonderful listeners who I know listen to this conversation and the many others that I've had with colleagues, that, you know, if they can take it on board and implement these things for themselves, role model them for them kids, then hopefully we can make tiny bits of individual change, even if we don't have the power to change the bigger system quite yet.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And my final word to you and your listeners is to always remember that it's much easier to build strong people than to repair broken ones.
Absolutely. And that's what we're aiming to do. I'm hoping to get the word out there. So I thank you very much for sharing your wisdom, knowledge, experience, and a huge mass of resources, of which I've tried to copy them all down. So I will put them all in the show notes for this episode so that people can refer to them. There's websites, there's research, there's a whole raft of different things, as well as your books. So I'll keep all of that detail there for people to be able to follow up. But thank you, Michael. I really appreciate your time.
Pleasure.
And perhaps we'll have another conversation again about technology.
That'd be nice. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for joining me and Michael for that sobering but important conversation about the mental health and well-being of our kids and young people. There are certainly plenty of challenges in front of our kids, but I remain determined to maintain my optimism. And I agree with Michael that those basic pillars of well-being, our exercise, diet, sleep and mindfulness, are a great place to start for all of us. This interview with Michael Cargreg was packed full of references and resources and places to find further information, and Jay and I have put links to each of these in the show notes. As always, you can find them at potential.com.au/podcast. There you'll also find links to further information about Michael and some of his recent videos and articles on the topics of kids and well-being, and I've put a link to some of his recent books as well. If you loved today's episode, please let us know. You can rate and review the podcast on iTunes, and that's the best way to spread the word about all of our guests and the work that we do in promoting well-being. You can also chat to me via email at ellenjackson@potential.com.au, on Facebook, via LinkedIn, via Twitter, via Instagram, and via the comment section of our podcast episode pages. Wherever you like to hang out, I will be there. And you can leave me a voice message too via the Potential Psychology website. Just go to the podcast episode and show notes page, click the orange button on the left-hand side that says start recording, and start the conversation. Next week is an episode for the boys and men. I'm speaking to Carl Nelms of Blokes Psychology, a psychology practice in Melbourne dedicated to working with men of all ages. And here's a sneak peek of what Carl has to say.
I always say to parents whenever I see them and I'm seeing one of their teenagers, I say, don't be afraid to nag the crap out of your son. The thing about a nagging parent is you never have to question if they care about you or love you or are thinking about you, ever. I said, in 5 or 10 years, you're going to look back and go, you know, mum was always on my back, but I knew that she always cared about me, was thinking about me.
I'm looking forward to bringing that to you. In the meantime, have a fabulous week, and I'll see you next time.